Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Il Paese di Cuccagna, Fantasies and Utopias of Food and Wine in the Italian Imaginary. This talk is delivered by Dr. Luisa Del Giudice.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Tonight, the seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Sciences welcomes to the Mediterranean Institute of the University of Malta Dr. Luisa Del Giudice from Los Angeles, California. Dr. Del Giudice is an independent scholar working in the field of oral history, oral culture, and cultural history as well, specializing very much in the cultural and oral history of the Italian peninsula. And she has written, published widely in various academic journals, and most recently she has edited a couple of volumes, one of them being Imagined States, Nationalism, Utopia, and Longing in Oral Cultures, edited by Luisa Del Giudice and Gerald Porter. Recently, last year, she extended her interest in oral history from the Mediterranean to Africa, and she was visiting professor of oral history at Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia. We're very happy welcome Dr. Del Giudice tonight, and she will be speaking on Il Paese, I want to get my Italian right, Il Paese di Cuccagna, the land of cocaine. This is talking about fantasies and utopias of food and wine in the Italian imaginary. Luisa, welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm really very pleased to be here and to see another part of the Mediterranean. We spent the entire day touring today and the island, and I was fascinated by what I saw. Gastronomic utopias. This is about gastronomic utopia and landscapes of longing. And it's not doesn't look just at the Italian, but the Italian diaspora. So it's about Italian immigrant culture as well. So let me begin. If you travel for 7 months, 4 by sea and 3 by land, you'll arrive at a gate. There stands a guard at the gate, and if you promise to obey the law of the land, he will let you pass through. And here are what the laws command. You must promise never to speak of work, only of eating, drinking, and sleeping. In fact, if you look over the gate, you will find an inscription, chi più dorme più guadagna, he who sleeps most earns most. If you refuse to obey this law, guards will immediately seize you and take you to prison, which, by the way, is made of cheese and sausage, so you could eat your way out. And as you walk through the streets, you will see some curious sights. Rivers are flowing with wine. Houses have walls of sausage and cheese. Roast chickens are falling from the sky. Fish are jumping out of the pond, and you can take as many as you like. There are caves of gold coins for the taking. There's a large palace of pleasure with perfumed beds. And right in the center of this place is a huge mountain. A cauldron sits on top, and maccheroni spew forth all day long, rolling down the Parmigiano mountain and landing in a pool of broth. Hens lay 200 eggs a day, sheep eliminate ricotta cheese, and ovens endlessly produce bread, cake, and pizza. There is no sickness and no poverty, and everyone holds the title of an aristocrat, a noble title. So if you are hungry and tired, my friends, forget your vegetables and come with me to Il Paese di Cuccagna, the land of cocaine. And so read this Neapolitan broadside dated 1714 and performed by street singer Giovanni Il Tranese. Here's the fat man. Il Paese di Cuccagna, known as Lubberland or Land of Cocaine in England, Schlaraffenland in German, Cocaine, a Cocagne, or Panigon in France, is a mythic land of plenty where rivers run with milk and honey, sometimes beer and wine. Food falls like manna from heaven, work is banished, and no one ever grows old. It represents one of the most persistent desires for a return to the earthly paradise lost, otherwise known in the Western tradition as the Garden of Eden. I'll show you some more slides. This is a German map of Schlaraffenland with all of the regions, all of the different provinces. This is Bruegel, of course, titled the Land of Cockaigne. Here's another print. In Italy, this mythic place becomes primarily a gastronomic utopia, confirming through the inversion principle of utopian thought that it represented a collective dream of the hungry masses, a poor man's paradise, reflecting back from a land of hunger. While food is essential to many Edenic representations, in the Paese di Cucagna, nature becomes hyperactive, surreal, and magical. Cows give birth to 4 calves a day, roast pheasants fly into your mouth, donkeys excrete gold coins. Unlike social utopias a la Thomas More, this place projects from the stomach and addresses basic needs, food, shelter, sex, and its longevity in Italian folk culture seems to document a constant in the history of Italy's lower classes of basic deprivations, well into the 20th century. I believe Cucagna still animates the Italian immigrant worldview and cultural practices. Further, although it is primarily articulated through edible spatial metaphors, the symbolic value of this imagined state rested in its ability to envision an alternate social order. And this dream to escape to a better world remained in popular consciousness for centuries. And it really was the driving force behind mass migration to America, which was otherwise known as Cucagna. I will not review the myth's literary history here, you know, from ancient Greek comedy to a 13th century French fabliau, and in Italian literature it's first found in a Calandrino tale in Boccaccio, and the name is changed to Bengodi. But be reminded that this utopia was un atteggiamento mentale, a mental attitude, before it became a praxis of the written word, according to Zaganelli. These motifs circulated widely in oral cultures, and in fact, Cucagna was most commonly described in that area of crossover between oral and semi-literary, in the penny press, diffused by cantastorie or street performers, that is, through broadsides. It is these Italian variants only, recurring with frequency, highest frequency from the 16th to the 18th century, that I'll be talking about this evening. Cucagna will also be of interest to food historians because gastronomic utopias reflect culturally determined tastes and cravings. So, for example, in a Norwegian version, you have rivers of sour cream and mountains of porridge. That's not my idea of gastronomic, you know, bliss. In France, you have, in a Panigon, you have trees of butter, rocks of melted cheese, and pigs stuffed with chestnuts. What do Anglo-Americans crave instead? Any idea? In the American hobo vision of food heaven, otherwise known as the Big Rock Candy Mountain, we have sugar featured, sugar and whiskey in this case. Whereas in this Disney version of Brer Rabbit's Garden of Eden, with a T, not Eden, but Eaton, apparently from the African-American tradition, we find hams, a chicken gravy river, hotcake plants, and a forbidden pork chop tree. Italy's Paese di Cucagna instead features a cheese mountain with maccheroni erupting from this cauldron on top. But remember that at this time, maccheroni were actually like gnocchi. That's what they were. If you're interested in this history of pasta, ask me for a reference. So you have this cheese mountain, rivers running with fine wine, and meats in great abundance. So it's heavy on protein. An inversion of the dietary norms of the lower classes based primarily on grains, legumes, and vegetables, the now fashionable Mediterranean diet. On occasion, it will also have a palace of sexual pleasure and always a prison for those who wish to work. So let me show you some images of these. So here we have the three main ingredients. You have the mountain of cheese, the cauldron with maccheroni, you have the palace of pleasure, and you have a prison for those who want to work. And this man obviously is being taken to prison here as well because he was doing what he shouldn't have been doing, wanting to work. Here's another version of it. Always the mountain of cheese. This man's being held in a barrel. Keep in mind this little vignette here. It will come in handy later on in the talk when we talk about carnival and Cucagna. Here instead we have a urban setting. We have a city, a walled city of Cucagna. All right. There is a truism in folklore which states, you are what you eat. That is, you are marked as an ethnic group by the predominant or the oddest food that your group eats. Give me some examples. The French. What are the French known as? Frogs. The Irish? Potatoes. The Germans? Krauts. The Mexicans? Beaners. What are the Maltese? Do the Maltese have an emblematic food? What would that be? Do you have?
Rabbit.
Okay. Rabbit. And Italians? They, of course, are still gastronomically stereotyped as pasta eaters or spaghetti benders. Anglo-Canadians, I grew up in Canada, Anglo-Canadians, at least to us Toronto Italians, are instead known as cake eaters, mangiacchecchi, or simply cakes. Again, this focus on the sweet, on sugar. And this stereotyping went on among regional Italians as well. Think of the blasoni popolari, Vicentini Magnagatti, the Vicentini cat eaters. And then also in this game, this is Il Gioco di Cucagna, where you have regional, different cities marked by the food that they eat. And recall here that the Neapolitans at this time were not maccheroni eaters, but broccoli eaters. And it has remained the basis of much regional perceptions of, you know, one region to the other. If you look at these what region are we looking at here?
Malta.
No. Although I did spot a lot of Fiki di India here today. They weren't exactly right, but almost. Sicily. Okay, Sicily. Molise, Abruzzo, sort of pastoral foods. Sicily. Panettone. Milano. Lombardia. Sardinia. Of course, here the nuraghe gives it away. Okay. This has taken on a rather sinister note, judging from recent propaganda of the ultra-nativist Lega Nord, Polenta si couscous no, inverting Northern Italian Polenta Polentoni into a badge of pride, a tool for exclusion of foreigners, including sort of perhaps even Italian, Southern Italians in this case, because Southern Italians do eat couscous. Interesting to note how virulent culinary racism can be. But not surprising, given that the centrality of food, literal and symbolic to Italian cultural identity. Cucagna represents festive time run amok. Unlike King Carnival, Cucagna has no calendrical restrictions and hence never dies. Cucagna and Carnival, as topoi of indulgence and perpetual abundance, are intimately intertwined. Here we have Il Trionfo del Carnevale. We have a procession of cooks carrying cooking utensils and the fat King Carnival triumphing above. Both in Carnival and in Cucagna, we have the centrality of meat, especially pork, as a live pig, roast pork, and sausage. It is a winter diet, clearly. In northern versions of Cucagna, you actually have a pig running around with a knife, and it's but ready for slicing. It's all, you know, it's already obliging. Okay. So Cucagna represents perpetual carnival feasting, and in many Italian dialects, Cucagna has simply been reduced to a synonym for feast. abundance. For example, as in che cucagna, che pacchia, okay, what a feast. And both carnival and cucagna represent a topsy-turvy or upside-down world. What were some of the traditional inversions of this roverso mondo? Here is another very typical print that you would find at the same time the cucagna prints were. And you have these inversions. For example, So fish, fishing, men dressing as women, etc. Women wore pants, men nurtured children, the peasant commanded over his lord, the deer took aim at the hunter, cows butchered butchers. So during carnival, the peasant did behave as master and men still cross-dress. The social rules were inverted. A carnevale, ogni scherzo vale. During carnival, any joke is permitted. But why was cucagna most popular during the High Renaissance, since this period seems more associated with wealth than with poverty? Actually, against the images of patronage and self-celebration, beggars and vagabonds now become endemic. For as food historian Massimo Montanari has shown, the real problems of poverty arose during the Renaissance as ever greater portions of the population were excluded from the natural resources of forest and pasture. Social historian Piero Camporesi best describes the underworld of the sick, the beggars, the charlatans, the pickpockets, thieves, itinerants, and the growing need for hospices and prisons in a wonderful book, and I don't know if you, it has been translated into English, The Land of Hunger, Il Paese della Fame. Images of richly draped lords and merchants and their splendid tables were common as the codification of social rank became important in every aspect of life, from the clothes one wore to the foods one ate, all carefully monitored through sumptuary laws. For example, with regard to food, it was held that one should eat according to one's social status. Mangiare secondo la qualità della persona. That is, proper to a peasant's physiology as though by some natural law, were roots, coarse breads, salt pork, and organ meat, while the noble's physique required fresh fruits, meats, and fish, white bread, and strong wine. To subvert this natural dietary order was to subvert the social order. In cucagna, instead, we find anarchic wines, prized malvasia, white breads, cake, and noble fowl. Display of power and ostentation were the order of the day, and it was not uncommon, for instance, to parade the elaborate and sumptuous dishes of a lord's feast, frequently ingenious architectural food fantasies, such as sculpted marzipan castles, around the public piazza before the gaze of the common folk, therefore thereafter to be consumed by the few. In fact, the poor did not have far to look to imagine culinary, gluttonous delights of cocaine. In fact, you often had on the public piazza wine in the fountains, spewing forth, you know, at festive occasions. And you often did have pheasants and peacocks cooked and dressed with their own feathers. And this sort of thing found its way into the cucagnesque landscapes. But famines in the 1500s became especially serious, and the search for new foods, such as corn and potatoes from the New World, for instance, to stave off large-scale starvation, came to fill treatises on agronomy. Meat consumption decreased all over Europe, and bread made from lower-quality grains became the mainstay of the poor. Basically, anything you could grind up and bake. And Camporesi describes this adulterated bread and the health hazards of using these lower-quality grains, some of which were toxic, were hallucinogenic. So by eating them, I suppose, you could actually have become delusional and participated in forms of aberrant social behavior spawned by hunger. Is it any wonder that mere lists of food, virtual food, might have hypnotized the street audiences in a mirage-like cucagna? So street performers, such as Giulio Cesare Croce, fed his audience words. These were broadsides, and a lot of the topic of these broadsides were hunger and food and these fantasy worlds where, you know, there was just as much food as you could possibly want. But where was this mythic land? And how could one get there? It was nowhere and everywhere, always relocating. For the German Goethe, it seems to have been Italy. For the Lithuanians, it was Hungary. To immigrants, it was America. In early 17th century Italy, the city which became most closely associated with Cucagna was the city of Naples. As it was then, so it has remained, a land of misery. It had the right social dynamics of extreme wealth and poverty required for Cucagna and Carnival to flourish. Topographically, too, one could imagine it as such, for the Maccheroni erupting mountain of Cucagna seemed none other than Vesuvius, another emblem of Naples. And by this time, the Neapolitans were known as mangiamaccheroni, macaroni eaters. Let me show you some slides. That's another Rovescio Mondo. Here we have another volcano, and this is called Plambodingola Napolitana. So I assume that's sort of whipped cream up there, and this is a plum pudding. Okay, so imagining another gastronomic Naples, other than the mountain of Cucagna. And here are mangiamaccheroni, and it was street food. You know, macaroni were street food, and you get them all through nativity scenes and in print and in many different versions. Pulcinella, which was the mask of, and he's frequently also eating macaroni with the hands. The masks of the different cities, and all through these nativity stories, I presepi, often food is lavishly portrayed as well. Interestingly enough, the Spanish and then the Austrian regimes of 18th century Naples, knowing the importance of this motif for Napoletani, actually staged periodic Cucagna festivals on the public piazza to distract the masses, to perpetuate the myth of royal benevolence. We have these grand structures called macchine della Cucagna. This is a macchina della Cucagna. Cucagna machines, literally. They were assembled on the public piazza as ephemeral, edible architecture on each of the four Sundays of the carnival season. Many of these structures took the form of temples, mountains, ships. And some are to be found, I found these in the Getty Collection in Los Angeles. They have quite a collection of these festival architectural creations. And here are, you'd actually have live animals that then would be hunted down. These are all Cucagna machines, macchine della Cucagna, fountains with wine. This is an interesting one because then it was painted as well. So you note that this is all, you have carcasses right here attached to the machine, and then bread, all encrusted with food. And from the balconies of the royal palace, the king and the aristocrats could view the frenzied struggle to dismantle these ornate Baroque food grotesques. The king's guard, right here, on horseback, gave the signal of attack, and in 5 to 8 minutes, the structure was completely demolished, picked apart by beggars or lazzari, sometimes knifing each other in the process, all under the entertained gaze of the court. These festivals actually had to be stopped during years of severe famine, as you can imagine. Even into the 19th century, Naples was still associated with Cucagna. In an 1891 novel entitled Il Paese di Cucagna, written by Neapolitan writer Matilde Serao, here we focus on the dark side of Cucagna, as it's used here as a metaphor for the lottery mania that was devastating rich and poor in the city. The desire for a material paradise on earth in this novel varies according to class. So by playing the lottery, a nobleman wishes to restore his family fortunes, a merchant to open a pastry shop in a more fashionable quarter of Naples. But to Antonietta, of the urban poor, to win the lottery would mean to eat macaroni and meat morning and night every day, a rather modest dream one might say, and yet one which eluded Italians until the post-World War II era. How many emigrants of the late 19th century mass exodus had similar dreams? We know many did board ship at the port of Naples and sailed for the New World, where the streets were said to be paved with gold, and where they believed they would never go hungry again. For Italians, America was alternatively known as Il Nuovo Mondo, the New World, La Terra Promessa, the Promised Land, and one should not discount the literal sense of this term, for peasants sought cultivatable land. And it was also known as Cucagna. How many Italian folk tales began with the scattering of large families due to famine, as children, often brothers, are sent into the world to seek their fortune? In Calvino, for example, there is a wonderful tale, Salta nel mio sacco, it's tale number 200 in his collection of folk tales, Jump in My Sack. And these tales, these folk tales, fairy tales, take on a curiously historical undertones, for they are also emblematic tales of migration. Personal experience narratives masquerading as folk tales, full of the marvelous, the strange, the new, endured among immigrants themselves. And Calvino, and we can corroborate it, had rightly maintained that le fiabe sono vere, fairy tales are true. Hunger as a theme was ubiquitous in oral tradition, in lullabies, in songs, in games, and in tales. And how many folk tales spoke of magic tablecloths or sacks or magic pots which produced food for the asking? So somewhere between folly and desperation and wish fulfillment lies the existential state of Cucagna. So many did board ship in Naples, as we did in 1956, in search of America in the general sense, in the generic sense. But as one wit has it, they quickly learned that not only were the streets not paved with gold, they were not paved at all, and the immigrants themselves would have to pave them. How do such fantastical dreams come to be believed by a people? And how can such narrative lies or fiction impact and change reality? Consider how the legend of the flying African, have you heard of this legend of the flying African, fueled a belief in the possibility of breaking the chains of slavery. This legend holds that the earliest African slaves could simply break their chains and fly back to their homeland. This was a legend. It's called the Flying African. This legend provided slaves with psychic defenses against the brutality of their daily lives. It taught that escape was possible, and many did escape. On the Underground Railway, some along a hidden route toward the north to Canada. I feel that the belief in Cucagna did as much for Italians escaping to the New World, emigrating despite the many accounts of shipwrecks and other dangers that they would encounter. I don't know, you, Marcello, you know the song, Mamma, 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 Dammi Cento Lire, che in America voglio andare. That was like one of the best known of the folk songs of immigration, where they, you know, there's a shipwreck and they end up. So it's a song of caution. Don't go. So these marvelous descriptions circulated among the peoples of Europe for centuries, and when mass migrations were finally possible, brought millions of the destitute to America, and still do. Cucagna became a powerful symbol of many common peasant and immigrant experiences. How far had the centuries-old songs and tales of street performers on the public squares of Italy or told around the family hearth taken a people? But the basic aspiration was the desire to feed a hungry body. They carried to the New World, as scholar Vito Teti notes, and here he's speaking of Toronto Italians, bodies marked and undernourished with an ancient hunger, an aspiration toward a better world, a world of abundance, that in the old country could not be achieved. And in fact, the most dramatic change for every immigrant regarded diet. Angelo Pellegrino, a writer of the immigrant experience, said about his arrival in America in the 1930s, and here I quote, "I found, first of all, the meaning, the consumable, edible meaning of a simple word lost in the dictionary among thousands of others, the meaning of the word abundance. As a child of post-World War II Italian peasants growing up in Toronto, Canada, I too had witnessed how food became the all-consuming focus of immigrant lives, worldview, and cultural practice. How food did indeed embody centuries-old trauma. The vast amounts of time and effort spent making wine, bread, pasta, planting gardens, gathering wild foods, fishing, always socializing around a table, ritually celebrating food itself, from the Sunday Eucharist in church and the Sunday pranzo at home, to Christmas and Easter feasts, lavish life cycle banquets, baptisms, communions, and weddings, or even just talking about food. We spent a lot of time talking about food. For example, stories recalling pre-immigration hardships, the trauma of procuring food during the war years, and sometimes the wondrous, truly Cucanesque tales, and I won't go into them here. In my own diverse research, I return to Cucagna time and again, for it appears to be so deeply embedded in Italian peasant and immigrant psychology and practice, in the immigrant's relationship to the land, the aesthetics of garden, the importance of wine cellars, food rituals, and the need to create and celebrate abundance over and over and over, to festivalize the daily. So this essay is found in this book. Let me turn to this. Cucagna was and is reenacted at every possible turn. For even though hunger itself, at least for Italians, has been vanquished, the fear of hunger has kept these food practices alive, producing its own cultural shadows. I've been starting to look at these cultural shadows. I think it's a very interesting how collective trauma lives on beyond its use. I mean, you know, slavery is the same for African Americans, the Holocaust that functions that way for Jews. I think hunger works this way for Italian immigrants. It's a trauma that you embody and you keep. It keeps returning in the most unexpected ways. Cucagna survives as a greased pole, l'albero di Cucagna, at Italian and Italian diaspora festivals. But you have it as well, don't you?
Yes,
the greased pole, but it's horizontal over ships, the like this.
There were two types. The passport was like then carnival, during the type of the nights, and then recently they tried to revise it, and then eventually it became even horizontal.
Into ships and then into the water, yes. Those are the two variants, I would amend. But, okay, and then on top you get prosciutto or money or, recently I understand that, with the gas prices going up, you even got buoni or discounts for gas, which would be, petroleum, which would be kind of useful. But it has also taken refuge in children's literature. You find this a lot in children. Many children's books feature edible landscapes or magic pots, but frequently they are cautionary tales. I don't know if you know the book Tommy De Paola, Striga Nonna. It's a wonderful tale. Basically a city getting overrun by pasta because the witch's helper has not watched. She has a magic pot, and she blows kisses to stop the pasta from flowing over, but he's missed that piece of the information. So she goes on to visit her comare in another town. She says, don't touch the pasta pot, but Big Anthony does, and then the whole town is overrun by pasta. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which was just made into a film. So if food dropped from the sky, would that be great, or would it be a problem? And it turns ugly in this book, actually. But let us return to Cucagna as an expression of the culture of poverty. Oh, this we did a slow food program on Uncle Kanya in Los Angeles. And these are some of the sagre, you know, kind of harvest festivals, wine festivals, when you do get food and drink distributed free to everyone, or at least supposed to be that way. These are some cultural practices of abundance. These are St. Joseph's tables, and I'm going to be talking about, this is a Sicilian practice, but practiced all over where Sicilians went, of this open table, where anyone who wants to come and eat from the table, it's meant for feeding the poor. And I'll be talking about this on Friday at the conference. These are some of images from these food altars. They are food altars. This is one we just did last month. And they are open tables. So this would, in Sicily, you would literally, you know, set a table. Maundy Thursday? Okay. This is St. Joseph's Day instead. This was just published as well. Okay. I'm coming to the last part of this. I want to return to Cucagna as an expression of the culture of poverty, because I've just experienced a land of hunger firsthand, and this is Ethiopia. And you can't even imagine the scandalous levels of deprivation until you've been to a country like Ethiopia. I came to better understand the topographies of longing. It seemed an appropriate place to speak of traditions of fasting and feasting, so I gave two public lectures in addition to the teaching at the Instituto di Agricoltura and at the university as public lectures. And these themes seem to strike a deep chord. I'm not sure how successful I was, but I was attempting to make subtle historic and global links, and to challenge all toward compassionate action. When I reflect on this recent experience of teaching and travels in Ethiopia, I find it an odd and perhaps cruel irony that Ethiopian sacred legend places the actual Garden of Eden, the head of the Nile, Abai, on Lake Tana. This is Lake Tana, a sacred lake dotted with Ethiopian Orthodox monasteries and still plied by biblical papyrus boats. Ethiopia, where it all began, our common ancestral mother Lucy, is what the tourist literature claims. So if this is paradise, why are so many still condemned to fasting? I'm not going to go in. I don't know all the economic reasons, cultural reasons, or historic reasons, but I know, and I was just talking to Paul driving over here, that every second sentence people are talking about development. I mean, there are more NGOs in Ethiopia than a lot of other places I've ever heard of. So for whatever the reasons, gastronomic dreams are rather modest by our standards. For most, it can be experienced on a single plate. I asked Ethiopians what they craved. Meat in abundance, preferably raw, literally just sliced and eaten raw, as tere sega, and this is wedding food, or roasted tibs, or as minced tartar called kitfo. Animal fats such as butter. This woman is making butter by hand, and it will take her 3 hours to make the butter. And tej, which is honey wine, mead, and it was forbidden during Menelik and up to Selassie's times. Dietary reality instead includes grain. Tiny grains of teff sustain the population. And what about rivers flowing with wine? Utopia can simply be a name for water. So here's the challenge. I often present to my co-ethnics and others, of course. Italians are no longer economic refugees in search of hospitable lands where they might satisfy deep and basic bodily cravings. But the world is still full of hopeful migrants attempting such journeys, and many are lost at sea, as you've all been reading in the newspapers, very close at hand as well. Most, of course, never want to depart in the first place. How might we, the now privileged, share traditions of hospitality to make the humanly universal promised land, earthly paradise, or Cucagna, more accessible to all? And this is what I've spent sort of the last few years doing, working on food justice issues in Los Angeles. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Louisa, for a fascinating, beautifully presented and very wide-ranging talk. I'm sure there are many questions. So shall we open up with any questions? Yes.
You showed us a pole, and you showed us a pole, and children were climbing up the pole, and you said that is the Kukanya, but you also said that the Kukanya takes place from a ship.
Oh, okay, that's another variant. So sometimes you have it on the piazza, and sometimes you have the greased pole this way.
But people we don't call it sole.
What do you call it?
We call it giostra.
Giostra, okay. But I was trying to say the whole land of cocaine has been reduced to this one ritual moment now in Italian festivals. So, you know, but if you go back, you find that it was a very articulated, highly elaborate, mythic land with all kinds of parts to it as well. So you have it and you call it giostra. So what kind of festival would you have a giostra at? Any festival or specific ones?
In Imsida. Yeah, in Sida, when the feast of St. Joseph is celebrated, on the eve of the feast, usually they have the giostra. And it's not for food, it's for money.
Okay, okay, interesting.
Even the Kukanya in Malta, which is done during Carnival. Mm-hmm. It's for money, not for food.
Interesting. Whereas in the Italian Kukanya, you would have the pole, you would have three elements. You would have prosciutto, some form of meat, a cheese, a money. So you'd have those like three things, right?
Yes.
Recalling the...
Before it used to be with food as well.
Could be. Uh-huh. I never read about it.
Uh-huh. So you've simplified it. It's less messy, you know?
But I've known the giostra since childhood. And it was always done for money.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Thank you. Thank you.
Money and the ability at swimming and at gliding.
So athletic prowess as well.
Yes.
And it's probably young men who do this mostly?
Yes.
Yeah.
And also at gliding, at going up a pole that has been greased.
Right. Yes. It's always a greased pole.
Yes.
The unattainable, something difficult to attain. And these places are often described, the land of cocaine, as you have to travel for 7 months and by sea. And, you know, how do you actually get there? It's always somewhere very distant. So that's interesting.
Why do you translate Kukanya into cocaine?
Because that's what the English word is for Kukanya. It's either known as lubberland or cocaine,
C-O-C-K-A-I-G-N-E.
And in French, it's Cocagne, C-O-C-A-G-N-E.
The French is it.
Right. But it's known by many different names, you know, in the various traditions. So in the Norwegian tradition, it can be Oleana, you know. In Panigon, also, Cocagne or Panigon in French, Schlaraffenland in German. So there are many names by which this mythic place is known in the European traditions.
Oleana, how do you write it?
Oleana, O-L-E, by Ole. You know, he was the one who convinced all the Norwegians to travel to, I guess, Minnesota and other places like that in America. Oleana. And there's a song called Oleana that talks about this as well. El Dorado. You know, this land has many components to it. So they're like the gold coins, right? So that it can become kind of a labor, there's a labor thing there as well. The prison for those who want to work. There's the food element, there's the sexual element, and actually there's a kind of a semi-pornographic picture, la cucagna delle donne, so there's a phallic cucagna pole as well. So they're like different elements in it, but in Italian tradition, it's almost been reduced to this food element because food is such an overwhelming thing in Italian culture. So it's mostly a gastronomic utopia.
One thing I found fascinating with the Kukanya is that it is a utopia without any catch, basically. There is no dark side to it, unless, you know, in the novel where it was associated with the lottery.
Whereas in others, in many other stories, there is always, you know, the utopia, yeah. but then there's something that yeah. spoils
beware,
the whole plot.
Beware.
So the Garden of Eden has the fruit, the forbidden fruit. Hansel and Gretel, there's the House of Sweets, which is actually a trap.
Mm-hmm.
In Maltese folklore, there is the land, there is this kind of mysterious land called Bofis or Bujibda, but it is, and people who actually go there might come back very rich, or they might come back with a tablecloth that produces food in endless supplies, but it's actually a very dangerous land, so mm-hmm. you might actually be eaten alive, you might end up frozen next mm-hmm. to a magnet,
mm-hmm.
so there's all these dangers. How do you explain the fact that the Kukania legends don't have this dark?
Okay, I have an answer for that. I have, at least have a hypothesis. First of all, in the children's literature, it's often got that dark side. It's like children beware, don't, you know, always wanting to eat sweets and all of that, beware, though, like Hansel and Gretel. You also get, in the literature, it's always cautionary as well. Like in literate culture, it is, there's, it's, that's a big part of it, is the dark side. So Calandrino in Boccaccio is a fool for believing in Cucagna, right, where he's going to get the heliotrope to make him invisible and, you know, all this stuff. But in the oral literature, in the street variants, it's a very indulgent, very, it's a different thing. First of all, because you're talking to mostly kind of a folk audience who are starving. You need to sell these things, so you need to make it attractive, right? You don't want to make it a cut. You want it to be kind of delight in all of this stuff. So I think that's why the ones that have come down to us are part of that oral tradition, mostly, that semi-literate, you know, oral tradition. So it's a much more indulgent view of this land of cooking, mythic land. You know, as I said, it's literally hypnotic listening to all of these foods. Just give me more detail. Describe the food. And they go on and on and on, all the different kinds of cakes and cookies and meats and this and that. So it's a different perception. It's a different attitude towards the thing. Yeah.
Thank you very much. It was a phenomenal lecture.
Thank you.
You put together an incredible picture, so rich in a variety of motifs, and it was entertaining as well as profound. While you were talking, I was reminded of many things, two out of them. One is my father was Sicilian,
mm-hmm.
and food was his favorite topic.
Yeah.
what we ate yesterday, what we are going to have today, what mm-hmm. we might have in a week from now. And then the memory came back to my mind of a short story written by a German writer, Erich Kästner, mm-hmm. For kids,
mm-hmm.
in which one chapter is the rise in Schlaraffenland. And intriguingly, now that I think about it, there is very little about food in this Paese della Cucagna. It is mostly about faulenzen, that is, to be lazy, just to lay in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it describes people so lazy that they would not find the energy to turn to the other side whenever. I wonder what one can make out of that.
Well, again, that's like the workers' paradise. So that's the opposite side to that, right? So there are different takes that can be, this thing can be sliced in different ways, to use a metaphor. A food metaphor. So, yes, in some traditions, it's more about the labor, being able to finally rest your body, you know, because if you think about the fight for the 8-hour workday, you know, that was fairly recent. So, basically, it used to be sunrise to sunset, and you know, all the canti popolari, all the songs that deal with these, the social protest songs, talk about this, you know. This sun that just won't set. And if you're in the south, you know, that sun can stay up. It's a long, long day. So, that's a big element that you will find in different traditions. And even in the Italian tradition, you can get La Leggera, you know, the canti della Leggera in the north deal with this as well. So, thank you.
It's very interesting to think that that you have what you call cultural shadows, this lingering mm-hmm. of collective trauma through food.
Yeah.
As you say, there can be other ways, but food, in a sense, becomes an embodied form of memory.
Absolutely.
So that, I mean, it opens up, you know, discussion here of how oral memory, collective memory works. Certainly not my field, but clearly one of the points that is being made, argued, is that it's not necessarily a mental process. It's a performative process.
And
so
an embodied
through performances,
process.
Ideas are retained over a long period of time. That's
food
could be one way.
Oh,
as you say, food is a very interesting way.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that I'm working on now, I gave this paper just recently, and I'm doing it again. It's an area that fascinates me. It's living memory and embodied ancestors. How do we embody these memories, these cultural practices, in our own, in our own bodies? I'm not starving anymore. My family's not starving, but we continue to be preoccupied with the food. It just, it lives longer than you expect it to. So third and fourth generation Italian immigrants are still very preoccupied with food. So maybe they're not doing some of those things that the parents did, but they're food writers, they're vintners, they're restaurant critics. It's not a coincidence. I think it's this trauma of the hunger trauma that can happen again. True.
Especially when you mentioned privilege. Yeah. We were not privileged, me and my brother. I taught something which no one else in the country knew after 5 years in England. Mm-hmm. And I was stopped from my work, robbed of my job at Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother, to keep me going, he died of hunger.
He died of hunger. Well, during the war, you hear these stories. My grandfather did too, essentially, and I know that one of my projects was wine culture and the place of La Cantina among Italian immigrants in Canada, in Toronto. And here was another thing, where you literally stockpiled food. So you're talking about the dark side of this stuff, and food disorders and, weird stuff. And I was going in and photographing, wine cellars in immigrant households. And literally this was like hoarding behavior in cantine, in freezers, in, basements. And the cantine were stocked with not just wine, but food, lots of food and pasta and, canned tomatoes and sausages and prosciutto and everything. It's like this fear that, this could return, you never know. So you've got to be ready. So the fear of hunger perpetuates some of these practices. So
it doesn't just perpetuate memory of injustice, but also it can perpetuate fear and caution, I think, too, as well, a strong cautionary sense as well.
There's also a good side to this, though, and that is, and this is what I've been dealing with recently, is that if you have this sensibility, and you have had this experience through your own body and through your own family and your own cultural group, it can and should help you be more compassionate to people who are going through this right now. I mean, how is it that we can suddenly forget who we were and where we came from, it's just inconceivable to me. There's a billboard in Los Angeles now that says 1 in 6 Americans deal with hunger. How can this be? I mean, food is a basic right. It's not a privilege. People should not go hungry. And, all of the statistics tell us that there is enough food if we just learn how to share it and share our resources worldwide, globally. I mean, not just locally, but globally. And so the good side to that could be, that you work for some of these issues. You convert it into compassionate action, which is, this is what I'm doing now. And just become very, very interested in how do what I know and what I experience, how can I apply that to the common good? And so last March, St. Joseph's Tables are a practice of Italians and Italian diaspora immigrants. So what we did was we went into a very poor area of Los Angeles where there are no Italians, and we simply made an altar. We made a St. Joseph's altar for a parish that is a 90% recent Latino immigrants, you know. So there are ways of using this. I'm not ashamed. I mean, I'm using it for these reasons. It's political. It's whatever. But it's social action for the common good, beyond our own tribes, you know, beyond our own.
I think the embodiment of ideas of injustice or fear is terribly important. I mean, in England, working class people continue to stock their new refrigerators full of. And the Sunday lunch became an absolute, you know, recollection, without words, an unworded recollection of times when there was less. I mean, my aunt was famous for a refrigerator, you know, stocked overflowing with even rotting, this notion of, you know, things, there's so much it rots.
And then it gets pathologic, right? And I mean, that is pathologic behavior.
It isn't, because this is very calm, in most ways, a very calm woman, a very calm, put together. She's a real matriarch.
Right.
She keeps the extended kinship group together. She writes to distant cousins all over the world, in Australia. But yes, the food is there on the table in excess abundance.
My oldest sister is like that.
Because they had rationing in the war, and they'll never forget it.
Yeah, that's true. You don't forget it. Or people who went through the Depression as well have that kind of, you know, show that kind of behavior. I have a sister like that, my oldest sister, who's like the matriarch, and she's totally into food. And, you know, she had one freezer, then she had two freezers, then she had three freezers. And when she went on vacation, we simply unplugged it and got rid of all the food. You know, so, you know, this is enough. You know, this is not healthy. So we gave it away.
I would like to hope that this stops this stops politics from going too far in any extreme. Because there will be a solid mass of people who will insist that the program, the ideology, must ensure the basic needs of a lot of people. Yeah. Just one other point that I'd like to make before we close, and that is that I was fascinated by the broadsheets you mentioned in 18th and 19th century Naples as being the actual way in which these stories were purveyed, and the street performances, because that ties in with so much social history that's being written, the making of the working class by E.P. Thompson, the whole school of social historians in England who are pointing out that there's been perhaps too much attention to political ideologies and to political personalities in their organization or mobilization, not enough attention to these very dense ways in which people exchange ideas and become mobilized. And I think it's fascinating to think. It's nice to think that at some level, and maybe at the level of the gut, ideas are very deep and are very widespread, you see.
Certainly when it comes to food.
Anyway, Louisa, thank you very much for a brilliant talk.
Thank you for having me.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Il Paese di Cuccagno, Fantasies and Utopias of Food and Wine in the Italian Imaginary. This talk was delivered by Dr. Louisa Del Giudice.